The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Bizarre.
Bazaar. Bazaar. Bazaar.
Bazaar. Bazaar. Bazaar. Bazaar. Bazaar.
This is Bazaar, the Bazaar and Weird Fiction Podcast with me, your host, Mr. Frank. Zoners, once again, we're going to do this, try to get you through another week of your life, but we'll just take 1 hour of your time or so, of course, as we always do. Zoners, what a week, a busy, busy week it has been. Of course, there are always busy weeks, but this week's been a little busier in the bizarro scene. Zoners, I'd like to start off the show by, I didn't want to have to acknowledge this, but I have to acknowledge this, and at least state my policy on the whole thing. As anybody who follows Bizarro, especially in the social media circles, knows, there's a certain turmoil going on. It's several issues that have swirled into one big shitstorm, and I've really just been ignoring it. It's too much, and I think a lot of people feel that way. My policy on Bizong, I have not acknowledged it, because my policy on Bizong is, this podcast is not a soapbox, a sounding board, or a thing to spotlight those types of issues. Bazong exists to spotlight and promote people who enjoy writing and publishing bizarre and weird fiction, and that is all I'm going to use this podcast to do. So I've had many of the people involved in the problems on this podcast. I have no problem with anybody that's involved with this now. You know, myself on a personal level, I'm fine with everybody. Everybody's entitled to their opinions or their actions, whatever. But, you know, I'm not going to have those people on the podcast to discuss the problems or to use Bazong as a platform for sounding off on their views on these issues. That's not going to happen here on Bazong. I think Brian Keene did a great podcast this past week, spotlighting some of the stuff that's gone on, and he toward the end of his podcast did an open letter to Bizarro, and I think it was a fair and justified and needed observation from Brian Keene, who is not really as entrenched as a lot of us are in the genre. So if you haven't heard that, maybe go check out Brian Keene's latest episode of The Horror Show with Brian Keene. Other than that, Bazong will continue to spotlight everyone and anyone who writes bizarre and weird fiction. That's what we do. I'm not going to spotlight anything else. So let's put that all behind us, Zongers, and continue on, shall we? Of course, we got to acknowledge the people who pay the bills here and keep Bazong on the air. I am, of course, talking about a subculture corsets and clothing.com. I'm sure you've heard us talking about how much we love subculture corsets and clothing here on the Project Entertainment Network. And they've got great rockabilly, alternative, and pinup clothing, but they have so much more. So check them out at subculturecorsets.com and follow them on Facebook, facebook.com/subculturecorsets. Or you can follow them on Twitter at @SC_corsets. Just Google subculture corsets and you'll see all of their social media pages. And follow them and be sure to visit subculturecorsets.com. I like to check the place out, you know. Lots of women's clothing there. They have men's clothing, which I'm in love with, and I gotta make up my wish list and save up my pennies. But the women's clothing, I was just looking through some, man, they got a great looking pinup dress. It's called the Red Sugar and Voodoo Dress by Hell Bunny. It is hot. It's this hot sugar skull thing. It's red with these cool sugar skull pattern thing going on. Hot stuff. Very competitive price. Plus, if you shop at subculturecorsets.com or go visit their store at the Avenues Mall in Jacksonville, Florida, just tell them Bazong and you'll get 10% off your entire order. That's just the one voodoo dress. Or if you get a voodoo dress and a corset and maybe a book or a kilt. I hear they have kilts now. The whole order, not just off one item. 10% off your whole order at subculturecourses.com. That's subculturecourses.com, or visit their store in Jacksonville, Florida at the Avenues Mall, just off I-95. So, Zongers, this week's guest, I keep going out of the United States for guests. It's very refreshing. It's promising, right? We're going back to Scotland. I spoke to John McNee a while back from Scotland, and our next guest, he keeps coming up. His name keeps coming up. People keep saying, you got to have him on. I want to hear him, and I'm interested in hearing this guy. He is from Scotland, Mr. Chris Kelso. Maybe a name you don't readily know, or maybe you do. He does a lot of background stuff, editing work, and he's worked with several Bizarro-based presses, so he's, like, around a lot. But, you know, people who know him have a lot of respect for his work, and so we get into all that stuff, talking about his work, talking about what it's like being a Bizarro over there in Europe, in Scotland, of course, and Great Britain. But we talk about the European scene that's kind of expanding. It's almost its own, you know, separate offshoot now. There's a Scandinavian presence over there. So Bizarro's, you know, not only expanding here in the Western Hemisphere, it's expanding all over the world. We had Kevin Donahue on, and he was talking about, you know, touring Europe and people in Amsterdam having a Bizarro festival. So I really enjoy getting to talk to people outside of the United States, just so everybody really gets an appreciation and understanding for how big this Bizarro thing really is. So without further ado, and I just want to warn you, Chris Kelso does have warning's a bad word. I just caution you, or get your ears tuned. Get your ears tuned. That's what I want to do. Chris Kelso has a really thick Scottish accent. I found myself mostly able to understand what he's saying. I may have asked him a couple times just to repeat, but you will have to keep your hearing tuned and acute, and you'll be able to pick up everything he's saying. He's very well spoken. It's just, if you're not used to that Scottish accent, it can be a little cumbersome to pick off what he's saying. So with that in mind, Zongers, I don't want to hang on that too long. So let's just go on ahead and give us the gong. I'd like to welcome to Bizong this week a man who's calling from clear across the pond, as they say. He is none other than the one and only Mr. Chris Kelso from Scotland. Welcome to the show, Chris Kelso.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
It's a pleasure having you here. I talk to so many now in the year I've been doing this podcast, so many writers and Bizarro writers from across the sea and across the borders, and it's really awesome that I have that opportunity to do that, because it means Bizarro is not just this American Portland centralized thing. It's really global, because the reach is global.
Oh, definitely. I think that's totally true. Actually, some of my favorite Bizarro writers, I think you always start off with the Eraserhead group, like Kevin Donahue and Carlton Mellick and all the kind of people, but then you kind of graduate to people like even like Brian Keane and Tom Bradley, and then, but I'd actually say some of my favorite writers just now are actually foreign Bizarro writers, like I don't know, you probably know Michael Fawn, who's Swedish.
I love Michael Fawn.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And you've got Love Call as well, he's also Swedish. And uh-huh. they're two like fantastic. It's like an interest in that kind of Scandinavian take on Bizarro fiction.
Yeah. I always ask Michael Fawn when he's gonna write a book about burning down churches, but he says that's Norway. And I'm just silly person.
I feel like he's done that already, you know? It seems like something. That's just kind of bread and butter. Lemon chops. Death metal and that kind of stuff. So,
I got to ask you, being over there in Scotland, how did you come to discover Bizarro?
Well, have you been to Scotland before?
I have not. The closest I've been is Ireland, out your way.
Okay, it's pretty similar, I'd say. It's got a... It's kind of hard to describe. Scotland, it's got horrible weather. It's very grey. It's very dull. It's a beautiful country, and I'm very proud of being Scottish, but it can be quite oppressive sometimes, like just the bad weather, and it kind of breeds this cynical attitude, I suppose. And everybody has got that kind of silent scream on their face. They've all got that kind of existential panic. We're quite an introspective race of people, I think. So, apart from being quite a kind of cynical, moody person anyway, I also happen to have been brought up in Scotland, which, you know, increases the kind of cynicism and moodiness tenfold. So I've always liked things like horror. I've always been that kind of like dark, cynical humour has always appealed to me. But I actually remember the first time I discovered Bizarro specifically, and it was, I just dropped out of university. I was studying law. I absolutely hated it. My girlfriend at the time had just dumped me. I dropped out of uni and I got a terrible job working in a bargain store. I don't know, the American equivalent to that would probably be like a thrift store, like that kind of thing. And I just absolutely hated it. And I was starting to explore different kinds of avant-garde films and books and stuff. So it was a kind of inevitable discovery, like that I was going to come across Bizarro at some point. The first book I ever read was Ape Shit by Carlton Mellick, which is it's kind of considered a bit of a classic in the canon of Bizarro fiction now.
Right.
And from then on, you get the Eraserhead and the Raw Dog Screaming Press and all the D. Harlan Wilson as well. He's amazing. And so yeah, it was. I can remember the most appealing thing about it was that it was. I know it's almost a cliche to say this because I think everybody who talks about when they first got into Bizarro says this, but the no holds barred approach to literature is really appealing. But more than that, I think sometimes people accuse Bizarro of having, it doesn't have very three-dimensional characters, and sometimes it's just out to shock for shock's sake kind of thing. But I think that, I disagree with the three-dimensional characters, because I think that there are a lot of great characters in Bizarro fiction. But I don't know, I think when you go to uni or when you're brought up, when you're at school, when you're studying English, like you're kind of forced, there's a lot of this literature that's kind of forced on you, and it's really off-putting. So I had no idea that there was anything like Bizarro out there until I went to university, and you know, you meet people and you start watching films, and then there is a kind of natural progression towards that style of art. Yeah, I totally forgot what my point was there, to be honest. I've been off on about a tangent. Sorry.
You expanded upon how you discovered Bizarro, but you're so right about that. That it breaks the conventions, that it's something you're not, you know, you can walk into your local bookstore and everything on the shelf is, it's conventional, it's comfortable, it's safe. Mm. Even horror, you know, there's a quote-unquote safety to it. And when you pick up a Bizarro book, the rules don't apply. It's untethered. The balloon has been cut, and it's floating free. And there's still something that has to keep it all together. Like, you know, let's say you have a guy working in a fast food place, and he's flipping burgers, but the guy is, you know, a fish or something, you know, one finned fish. Now, it sounds crazy, but like if you did that as a children's cartoon, that would make sense somehow as a children's cartoon. But with Bizarro, that sort of plot, that character is presented as like within the confines of a real world. Everybody else is normal, but here's this, you know, one finned fish flipping hamburgers. And then the rest of the story is, you know, revolves around how the world would work if that were so. And I think that's how kind of Bizarro works. It takes one absurd sort of premise and tries to work within the confines of the normal world and see what happens there. A lot of Bizarro anyway, there's all kinds, but that's I think the main.
No, I totally agree. And I think that's another thing. You totally hit the nail on the head there when you're talking about taking that kind of absurdism and introducing it to things like science fiction and horror. And even some of the things can be quite formulaic. Like you can still get formulaic, bizarro stories, like a love story or whatever it is, but they've always got that slight kind of, I don't know, like a wee kind of like slightly left of centre twist that really makes it seem kind of relevant and interesting. And I think its roots lie in things like Gogol and like even kind of like Kafka. There's quite a lot of kind of Kafka elements involved in bizarro, and I think people think it's mainly B movies that are the kind of driving influence, the main influence there. But I don't know. I don't really see that, to be honest. And yeah, it's also, I mean, kind of unashamedly quite kind of, I don't know, I don't think it takes itself too seriously either, which is really nice to see with something like in literature as well.
That's very true. You have John Skip famously says, you know, bizarre is what happens when fiction takes off its pants at a party, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good, I like that.
Yeah.
John Skip wrote a great bizarro book with Mark Leventhal. I don't know if you've read it. Is it the Emerald Burrito of Oz?
Oh, I've not. I've not been able to read that.
Check it out. It's amazing. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And you just need to look at somebody like John Skip, or you think about bizarro and the people who are big aficionados or big celebrators of bizarro. People like John Skip, and he is and Brian Keane, and they're really well established authors, like even within almost kind of mainstream fiction in a way, like they have got a pretty big audience, and they love bizarro, and it's a real testament to the genre, to be honest.
Yeah,
when people like that get behind it,
I personally credit Brian Keane with leading me to bizarro, because he signed on with Deadite, and then obviously Deadite leads to Eraserhead and opens up the whole world. And that's simply because I was a Brian Keene fan, and he went to, you know, Deadite when everything collapsed. So, and I just spent 24 hours in a room with him a few days last week. He was doing a telethon for his podcast. And, you know, the few times I've met him, and he's on this podcast network as well, he says, you know, I love your show. I love what your show is doing. I love bizarro. And it's hard for me to talk about bizarro to my audience, because a lot of horror people, a lot of established classic horror people, don't want to hear about it. They roll their eyes. It's not, you know. So it's difficult for him to wave the flag for it, because a lot of his audience just doesn't want to hear it. So he appreciates this podcast where it is, you know, the premise to wave the flag and unhindered.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know, I think as well, when you were talking earlier on about how I got into bizarro, Brian Keane is somebody, kind of going a wee bit off topic here, but we were talking about Brian Keane, so I suppose it's still kind of relevant.
That's fine.
I've got a lot of, I think I owe him quite a lot, because when I had dropped out of university all those years ago, and was working in a horrible job, and like, it's not very inspirational set of circumstances to find yourself in. But I was sending out requests to edit, or to, you know, like to read slush piles at various publishers, and Eraserhead, and it was actually Kevin Donahue who got back to me and put me in contact with Jeff Burke, who was running Deadite Press at the time. And I think one of the first books he gave me was a Brian Keane. It was like a kind of reissue of like a few stories. And it was amazing. And I don't know, they weren't the outright bizarro. But Brian Keane, I know he's a very, I think he's not a very experimental writer, if you know what I mean. But you can tell he's got a real appreciation for that type of no holds barred approach to fiction.
Yeah.
Right, so, but he had a big audience, and he also wrote horror, and he wrote science fiction, and he writes bizarro, so he's like a real genre writer. And I think now I'm trying to adopt a kind of similar tack, because the initial stories I was writing were kind of bizarro, kind of like two on the nose almost, like the work I was kind of stealing stories a wee bit. But then when you find your own voice, it's strange how much you kind of, you actually move away from writing bizarro fiction. And then you just end up writing sort of horror. I mean, the last book I had was the Folger Variation, and it's just a kind of time travel science fiction book, but it's got, I still think it's got the kind of bizarro elements in it. Like, it's still got I don't know, characters who are like drug addicts, and various hallucinations are happening, and I don't know. And then the book before that was the Unger House Radicals, which is a kind of horror crime story, much more in the vein of maybe like Jonathan Mayberry or something like that, you know. So, I've totally lost my point. The reason why I'm all over the place when it comes to this is because I obviously explained to you before, I'm kind of babysitting at the moment. So I've got one eye on the kid, and then I've got the television there, and so apologies if I'm a bit kind of scatterbrained just now.
No, I get it. I have kids too, and you're trying to focus on something like writing, and I always say, like, I remember was writing this really, you know, like a bloody, gory scene of somebody getting eviscerated, and then the kid comes up, tugs me, and says, "Daddy, can you change the dress on this Barbie doll?" And that's a very jarring thing to switch gears from that. So I totally get it. But you were just talking about, you know, Brian Keene and his irrelevance to Bizarro is basically the gist of what you're getting at. And for you, how, you know, even though he's not necessarily Bizarro, but he's a very risk-taking writer. And I think another big appeal for Brian Keene in Bizarro is that he's a real writer's writer. Like, he is a big supporter of other writers and tries his best to, you know, pass down his knowledge and be supportive of everybody who wants to try writing. And that includes Bizarro's, you know, just like a John Skip. So even though he doesn't necessarily write it, he's a big supporter of everybody in Bizarro. And that makes him an important figure in Bizarro. He told me at the telethon I was doing off mic before the mics were live that he's writing a Bizarro thing, which I don't think is a big secret, but he said it is so hard for him, you know. It's hard for him to stay in that weird mind space while you're writing. And I get it, too. I love reading Bizarro constantly, but when I try to, like, really sit down and write pure Bizarro, it's very difficult to stay in a mind space where the rules don't apply. It's hard. It's so weird.
It's also difficult to not seem too deliberate as well. Like, because for all it's kind of shock for shock's sake and the kind of schlock horror thing that goes on, it is quite nuanced as well. Like, there are some rules that you need to apply as well. Like, you can't just be like, well, I don't know. I mean, you could come up with a simple premise, like there's a fish-headed man who works at a flipping burgers kind of thing, and it is this kind of self-contained world kind of thing. But the execution of that premise into making it into a story is something completely different. Like, you have to be quite disciplined as well. Like, I think to sit down with the intention of writing something bizarro, is you're doomed for failure. I think you just need to sit down and no restrict yourself. Like, don't try and censor yourself, but don't be too deliberate at the same time, I suppose. And it is quite difficult. Like, I don't think I can write bizarro fiction anymore, actually. I just don't think of, and it's not that I don't want to, I just don't seem to. Strange, like in a state of mind that you fall into sometimes when your life situation can even affect that. Like, I've recently, for the first time, moved in with my girlfriend, and she's got a stepson, and I don't know, I'm still writing, but the content is changing all the time. Like, for some reason, this kind of, I've been thrust into this kind of family atmosphere, like, and I'm really enjoying it, but I don't know, for some reason the bizarro, it's just not happening for me just now.
Yeah, I when I write, it doesn't come out bizarre. I write like a humorous horror type. That's kind of what my voice is. Yeah. Even if I want to sit down and try to write something dark and scary, it still comes out silly and funny. But I think it's probably because I do this podcast, and probably because I talk about bizarro all the time. Inevitably, when people review my books, they just say it's bizarro, which is, it's fine. It's not. But, and I think there is just enough weirdness for people who don't know Bizarro to go, well, this is not not regular stuff. So it must be this Bizarro he's always talking about. So it's still,
yeah,
it still has the weird there, I guess, from normalcy. Go figure.
Yeah, there are so many like genres and subgenres now. It's really exhausting, I think, because you've got weird fiction and you've got the new weird and you've got, oh my god.
Like, yeah.
I love Bizarro. I love that it happened, but I'm really wary of being pigeonholed.
Yeah.
Bizarro author.
I just want to put it out there. It's, you call it what you like. I just wrote it.
Yeah, definitely.
It's so much easier if you could do that. As far as writing Bizarro figure, were you already writing, you know, Bizarro kind of weird things, or was it discovering Bizarro that kind of set off, you know, the weird in your writing?
Do you know what? I found an old laptop recently, and it had all my old stories from when I was at school, and I was just kind of expressing myself. I was no intention of ever letting anybody read them or anything. And they're terrible, but they are really, really fucking weird. Like, really, and they probably do kind of come under the term Bizarro. And maybe when I discovered Bizarro fiction, I made that kind of connection in my head and really felt like I belonged, that there were a lot of kind of kindred spirits out there who had a similar kind of warped style of writing. So yeah, it did seem quite natural, and then I don't really think I had to alter my style or anything like that too much when I was writing stories and sending them out to get published. So yeah, so I probably was weird. I'm quite a weird person, I think. I've got Scotland is the perfect place to be if you want to write Bizarro fiction. By the way, it's amazing. Like, I work in a place called Dunmellington. And it's Dunmellington, sorry. That's my Ayrshire accent. Sort of crushing words together again, letters together, aren't they? So, but I work in a place called Dunmellington in a school. And Dunmellington is, you probably don't know anything about that much about Scotland and the landscape up here. But Margaret Thatcher, who was the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, decided to shut down all the mines in Scotland, and that was one of the main industries that we had over here. So a lot of kind of small mining communities who and these towns were created with the sole purpose of housing miners. You know what I mean? That was the only reason they existed. So then you take away the mining industry, and there's nothing else there. So it turns into this strange microcosm of, I don't know. It's really hard to explain. You would have to see Dunmellington for yourself to really understand it. It is full of the craziest people, because it's so isolated as well. Like, it's out in the middle of nowhere, and yeah, but it's really fascinating. It's like the Twilight Zone or something. You know what I mean? It's an amazing place, and there's loads of places like that throughout Scotland. So it's a really inspirational place. Like, you're never short of inspiration when you're writing, because some of the characters in Bizarro fiction, they exist in Scotland in reality. Mm-hmm. So you should try and come here if you can. If you ever show inspiration,
I would love to. There seems to be, there's a pretty strong presence, I think, of Bizarro writers in Scotland. It seems like, yeah, yourself, John McNee, or just in the region. Are you finding that? There's an audience for it in Scotland?
Yeah, I think there is. Not quite in the same way that it is taken off in America, like places like Portland and all that kind of thing. Like that it's pretty big. It's got a following over there. But I think there's definitely more of an awareness now. There was a Guardian article a few years ago, I think, that really raised the profile of Bizarro fiction in the UK in general. And I do think that in other regions of the UK, like England and Ireland as well, like I think it's probably England especially, because it's a bigger country, there's more awareness of Bizarro and more of a following. But in Scotland, we're a really small country, but there's nobody who I have introduced Bizarro to that hasn't instantly loved it in Scotland, because I think it must, there must be something really resonant about it over here. But we do this thing in Glasgow called the Speculative Bookshop.
Yeah.
And I always talk about Bizarro. The guy Dale who runs it, he's always talking about Bizarro. They get like a wee stall of books, and there's loads of Bizarro books in there. So there are kind of like small factions that are really pushing it. So hopefully, you know, like that has raised the profile a bit in Scotland. But a lot of the people in Ayrshire, especially where I live, that people, and I've worked in libraries for years as well, so a lot of the people love crime fiction, they love all that kind of stuff. So I don't know, we need to get more Bizarro books in libraries over here, and I think that would really enhance its profile.
Yeah, I think.
But again, as I say, like everybody who I've let read it loves it. Like the people who love like extreme horror and all that kind of thing. Like there's a big horror audience in Scotland. So so Bizarro is obviously,
it's got an appeal.
Would be appealing. You know?
Well, that's good. That's refreshing to know that you know they're taking to it easily when they do get exposed to it. It sounds like, and you're right there. You're the guy helping out spread that word, man. Maybe you could be. You could be part of that revolution there. I know I was talking to Kevin Donaghy, and he was saying like he went to Amsterdam and was doing a whole presentation on Bizarro stuff, and they were really into it, and he was kind of shocked to see that there sort of was already an Amsterdam version of, you know, like Bizarro. Like they already had their own homegrown sort of Bizarro literature thing already going on there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I know, and I think that actually happened in Poland as well. I think there was like a. I think it's probably just something in the collective conscious, to be honest. That, you know, I think we're all thinking the same things. Like, and we're all. Like, I mean, Bizarro is obviously a reaction to sort of stuffy, turgid literature, you know, of old. And I don't think there's anything particularly. I don't think that's a unique thought. I mean, we've always been pushing the envelope and trying to do new things. Like when it comes to art, like that, I don't think that's specific to like Portland. Although the Eraserhead guys are going to get a lot of the credit for sort of giving it a name,
yeah,
and really running with it and stuff, and making it really successful, and they deserve all that credit. But I think. You know, I mean, I think those ideas are already in people's heads. So, like, in Poland, there pretty much is a Bizarro scene that is completely independent of the sort of US equivalent of it as well. So, yeah, maybe in Scotland there will be... although I would say, to be honest, the fiction over here isn't just as avant-garde. I think it is... A lot of the writers I know, there's an amazing science fiction community in Scotland. Like some of the best science fiction writers in the world just now are actually Scottish, and a lot of great horror writers as well. But no so much with the crazy avant-garde, experimental, absurdist, surrealist stuff. But that might change. John McNee's a pretty daring writer, I think. I think he markets his stuff as horror. But I think as much. I think there are more layers to it than that, to be honest.
Well, I do notice that, you know, at least from the stuff coming out, like European, shall we say, it tends to be more sci-fi, more fantasy type. Like you said, Michael Fawn is out that way in Sweden, and he has like a real fantasy edge to his stuff. So I guess it's just, like you say, regionally, like Scotland has that sort of dark grayish atmosphere to it all the time. So that sort of thing might come out.
Has that kind of Wicker Man thing going on?
Yeah.
Like, so, yeah, I know. But the lines between horror and science fiction and Bizarro, like, they're, you know, I mean, I think they can blur. So I don't think it'll be too long before we see more writers and coming out of Scotland and the UK who are pushing it a bit more when it comes to content. So yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. You do a lot of work with Garrett Cook. You know, we were talking about, you know, staying and keeping in that bizarro mindset. And I took a workshop with Garrett last year, maybe 2 years ago now. And, you know, to try to like stay, you know, find out what it is to make things bizarro. And I took his bizarro workshop, and he preaches a dream. You're right in like a dream state, this sort of disconnected dream state. And it was really eye-opening to see those little techniques to keep things bizarre. I know you do a lot of work. You worked with him on the Imperial Youth Review and editing stuff. How'd you come to work with Garrett?
I loved Jimmy Plush, Teddy Bear Detective, when I was a university dropout. That was one of the first books. So I just reached out to him because, you know, I love it, and it probably is still my favourite. Although I don't really think he's too crazy about it anymore, because I think he wrote it quite a while ago. But it was one of my favourite books, so I thought I would reach out to him, and he was really nice. So I was working. I was a kind of associate editor at a British I suppose they are a bizarro publisher, Doghorn Publishing, which is run by Adam Lowe. And Adam suggested to me that we should get a magazine together. And I thought, well, it would be great to get some of the guys in the USA, like the Kevin Donahue's and the Jeff Burks and the Carlton Mellick. And for some reason, Garrett Cook, I just had his book in my head, and I asked him if he wanted to co-edit it with me. And astonishingly, he said yes. So... And it was so surreal, because when you meet and he was a hero of mine, do you know what I mean? Like, when you meet, it's kind of like when you met Brian Keane, like, you're a fan of his work. I mean, do you know, still think, have moments when you're like, holy fuck, I'm sitting here talking to Brian Keane. Like I have those moments all the time when I'm talking to Garrett. Like, I'm still like a fanboy.
Yeah, yeah.
When I'm talking. So it is a real privilege to work on that with him. It really is. It's kind of crazy thinking about it, actually, because all the writers who I kind of idolized when I was that age, like, I kind of know them now. It's really surreal.
It is when you idolize them so much, and yet you're working shoulder to shoulder with them. It does become like a "how did I get here" type of moment.
Collaborating with them as well, it's insane.
And Imperial Youth Review, I mean. That's really an important, like, it's something a lot of bizarros look to as you know, an example of where you're going to find, you know, what's bizarro fiction. Imperial Youth Review is one of those things, you know, you talk about, you hand somebody, this is, you know, a particular brand of bizarro fiction, shall we say. And it sets a bar, I think. And so whatever, what you put together there, it was really important, I think.
Thank you. That means a lot. And that was 100% the intention as well. Like, we wanted to elevate the genre to, I don't know, like, we wanted to get, like, I mean, we had Tim Lucas, we had, there's somebody at the door now. Oh my God. This is a nightmare. Sorry. I'm just going to ignore it. So if you hear chapping, don't worry with it.
It's fine.
Yeah, that was completely the intention, was to get people like Tom Bradley, who are real, like, they're wordsmiths as well, like, their prose is amazing, and they're writers, and it was giving them a platform, and a bigger audience as well, because you've got people like Jeff Burke, who's in the first issue as well, and Cameron Pierce was in the second issue,
mm-hmm.
and they've got a big fan base already. So, and Nick Mamatas was in the first
the names that you got were definitely, just by the names alone, you were definitely being serious about this. You were looking to create something special, and you succeeded in that. Absolutely.
Thank you. And the last issue was probably the best example of when we were trying to get, like, bigger names, when we get the William Burroughs and the Allen Ginsberg reprints as well. So. Mm. And I think it's all connected. You know, I think the science, that's the great thing about Bizarro, is it's almost impossible to define, because there are so many facets of it. Like, it is the beat generation. It's It's new wave science fiction, it's horror, it's romance, it's drama, it's, I don't know, it's surrealist, experimental, it's just everything. So it's pretty good when you're trying to compile a magazine, because you don't have the, again, when you're editing, you're not restricting yourself at all. You're able to go after pretty much whoever you want. Mm-hmm. And that is tremendously freeing as a, like, from an artistic point of view. So,
did you think it would do as well as it did, being a literary magazine in the age of digital publishing?
No, I didn't actually. And that was Adam Lowe, the publisher. He kind of warned us beforehand. Like, he forewarned us that magazines don't really sell at the best of times. Mm-hmm. And he put, I think there was actually quite a lot of money put into the production and of that first issue. And we paid, I'm sure we paid pro rates as well. So we definitely, we made a loss, but we knew we were going to be making a loss. But it was a labour of love, and everybody who was involved in it, for the publisher to the editors to the contributors, were completely behind the idea. And even if we never sold one copy, I think we would have been pretty happy with the end product and pretty proud of it as well. I don't even think there's no an e-version. There is no Kindle copy of the Imperial Youth Review. I don't think Doghorn actually does a lot of Kindle e-pubs like that. So it's quite risky. Probably risky more so today to do something like that, because everybody's got a Kindle now. But at the time, the Doghorn took a real risk with it. But it wasn't really something that we discussed at any great length. We just kind of did it, just for the sake of making something that was worthwhile. So, yeah, I know. And I would totally do it again. And we still make Imperial Youth Review, and it's still just print only.
Uh-huh. It's still going, huh?
And so, yeah, so I don't see that stopping.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. I did not realize that it was still going.
Issue 3 came out just before Christmas, I think. So.
Oh, wow. Great.
Yeah, that was the one that's got Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg in it. That was quite an interesting story, actually, just when I've got you there. I don't think a lot of people know how we got access to the Burroughs reprints.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I did an anthology called This Is Not an Anthology, and we had people like Joe Ambrose, who's Iggy Pop's biographer and stuff like that in it. So meeting those kind of people, we got access to the Plymouths, like Pam and Charles, who are in charge of a lot of the kind of old Beat generation, or the Beat writers' estates. So through Pam and Charles, I was able to speak to people like... God, I can't even remember his name now. The guy who's in charge of the Burroughs estate, and he offered us all these things, and I don't know, it was amazing. And it had Allen Ginsberg, unpublished Allen Ginsberg poems, and really willing to let us use whatever we want for no money, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. And the Plymell family have been, I owe them so much as well. Imperial Youth Review actually owes them so much, because probably every big name we've had has been through them. So,
you do some poetry too. You've dabbled in poetry.
Yeah. I'm not a very good poet. No. I'm not very good.
At least you admit it straight out. Why do you? Is it something you have to get out of you, even though you don't feel you're a good poet?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe I. Yeah, it's kind of. Almost McGonagall-esque. It's pretty bad, and it's always science fiction poetry, which I think is a bit. Unless you're Edwin Morgan, I think that's quite a difficult thing to pull off. So I don't know. I mean, why do we do anything? Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not going to make any money for the books at all, and I've got loads of books out, and I don't think I make. I couldn't even afford to, I don't know, a one-bedroom flat with the money that comes in for all the books. So, I don't know, what is the motivation? I think it's just sometimes it comes out as poetry. Like, it's really as simple as that. And the thing I learned from Bizarro is not to censor yourself, so and not to restrict yourself. So when you sit down and you've got the urge to write, just do it, just and see what comes out. And sometimes it's poetry. And I was lucky to get some of that poetry, some of that really quite bad poetry, actually published in a really great South African journal called New Coin, with Gary Kaminsky is in charge of. So yeah. I know it's getting published as well, which you know they shouldn't encourage me, because it's really very poor, the poetry.
And yet you put it out there. Why do you still put it out there? You don't think so highly of it.
I think I'm just a glutton for punishment. I think I just because I mean I don't know about yourself, Frank. Like when a book comes out, when you've written a book, you think it's great, and then you send it to publishers, and if you're lucky enough to get it published, you're really excited, but then when the sort of contributor copy arrives and you read it, I don't know about you, but I always hate it. Like straight away, the love I had for that book just disappears, and all you see is faults. And so is that the same for you, or are you?
Yeah, I get the same thing. Is you know, you sit there. I've only self-published, so you know I'm sitting there and I'm doing the layouts of the book and putting it all together. And it's like you say, it's that moment when you click, you know, publish, and you're about to, like, what am I doing releasing this piece of shit into the world? Even though I've just labored over this thing for hours and hours, putting together, polishing it up, making it the best thing. It's that moment when you're making it real. It's like, what am I doing with this garbage and nonsense? And especially I'm self-publishing, so it's like, this has not been vetted by anybody. It's just my own merit that I'm putting this out in the world. So what am I doing? So fortunately, I've basically had good feedback on my stuff, so that helps wipe away some of that doubt. But I think it's like you say, I think every writer has that, like, this is garbage. What am I doing? Doesn't really ever feel positive.
I actually think publishing stuff is like in a weird form of like masochism, to be honest, because I don't know, like, I remember every bad... I'm quite vulnerable to criticism, I think. Like, I can take constructive criticism well, but and let's say like I've got a book that comes out and it gets majority 5-star ratings, but there's one person who thinks it is dog shit. That is the one I'll focus on, and I have threatened to quit so many times. I don't know if you ever heard the Zero Books podcast with Douglas Lane. I was on that, and I pretty much had a meltdown on live in the podcast.
Oh boy,
fucking nightmare. And he had to like talk me down, and oh, it was a nightmare. It was awful. And that was really just my reaction to just feeling like I'm no selling any books. The very few pieces of negative feedback that I get really cut me deep. Do you know what I mean? And you need to be tougher. Like I really need to be much tougher, I think, if you're going to be in this game. Because I mean, it's a big thing, like to write something and put all your effort and your heart and your soul into it, and then let people read it. And some folk just think your best isn't good enough. And yeah, so I think with the poetry, even as I'm writing it, I kind of know it's terrible. But I don't know why. It's almost an unconscious thing that I'm sending it away to publishers and magazines. And yeah, I think it maybe is like a kind of, like Freud talked about a death drive. Like everybody's got this subconscious desire to die. Maybe I've just got a slightly heightened death drive. Maybe I just...
It's making it...
Failing publicly is weirdly kind of arousing or something. I don't know. You know?
It's masochistic.
Yeah, it's totally masochistic.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you're alone in that. And I don't... You know, for me, I like to think I have a thick skin as far as bad reviews go. And in all fairness, I haven't garnered enough reviews to really get a bad one yet. So, you know, I've had one where it was just a short story in an anthology, and somebody it was like the lead story, and somebody was like commented it like it wasn't worthy of being a lead story, and there's all these problems with the story and all this stuff, and I was just I don't know, kind of dismissive of it. So like I didn't take that type of thing so bad, but I haven't had that one scathing 1-star review yet neither, so I don't know how I'm going to react to that when it comes.
But then, if you're thick-skinned, it totally makes sense to express yourself artistically and bring other people into the equation. But for somebody like me, who's quite sensitive, it makes no sense to do that. Like, it just seems like there's not even any monetary gain. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's a really strange decision that I've decided to get into this. I still remember the first one star review ago. Oh no, sorry, it wasn't the first one, but it was a one star review of a book called Transmatic. And I think the gist of it was, what was it again? It was like a facsimile, I can't remember what he said now actually. A poor pastiche of Burroughs and Philip K. Dick without the charm or character development or something. So every time I think about, I don't know, like a book coming out, I'm just paranoid I'm going to get that review again. So, yeah. But, I mean, if you're thick-skinned, then I think you're going to succeed. I think that's what you need to succeed. Apart from having good material as well, I think you do need to have kind of belief in yourself a bit. So,
I know writers who will just not read their reviews because they are that disturbed, you know, by the poor reviews. They let it get to them that badly that they just will not read any of their reviews because they don't. They have so much, I guess, self-doubt from reading those things that they can't bring themselves to do it because it'll adversely affect their work, you know, going further.
I mean, I would love to hear, like, somebody like Brian King or Nick Mamatas, like, I would love to hear how they feel about negative reviews. I know that they get probably that many that mean anything to them, but I would, that's why on my blog I've got this, thing that I get established writers to do guest posts for me, and they're always established writers, and they always, it's like advice for young writers who have just put a book out, or how to deal with negative reviews, or that kind of thing. But I would love to hear somebody of Brian King's kind of stature and hear if he is still afflicted with self-doubt and stuff like that. I'm sure he is, you know what I mean? But
he's accrued
such a fan base, and he's good, you know, he's so successful. Like, you would imagine that would be enough validation for him.
But, yeah, that you have
you never know.
1,000 good reviews, and does the one bad review get to you or not? Or does the 1,000 good reviews just trump it all?
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah, but it's pretty good though, because at this stage, a lot of the people I talk to are other writers, so you do get to kind of use them as a sounding board for, I don't know, like ideas, and you can talk to them about things as well. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's important to stick with them. Mr. Chris Kelser, we're coming to the end of our time together, but, you know, I want to talk about, I'm not clear on this. You have a book out. Is it out yet, or is it about to come out? The Black Dog Eats the City.
Oh, that book came out in 2014.
Oh my God! Why is your website is criminally behind itself, because it says coming soon.
I need to. I'm sorry. I do need to update that. Actually, that's not your fault. That's totally. That book actually did quite well. Like, for me, surprisingly, that was a book that did quite well.
Uh huh.
But the last book that was out was Hunger House Radicals.
I see, yeah. Okay.
The kind of crime existential horror story that I did, which isn't bizarre at all, really. But yeah. I could send you a copy if you like.
That's with Crowded Quarantine, is it?
It is, yeah. That's Adam. I know he's been on the show as well. Adam, I'm sure you've had Adam on before.
No, I've not. I need to get him on. I totally need to get him on, because, and I know he's just had some, he just had a kid, and he had some issues, so I'm sure he's very focused on that, but I'm definitely going to have Adam on in the future, because he is, I don't know, I feel like he's quietly building something huge there with Crowded Quarantine, I think, but I don't think it's really gotten a lot of notice just yet.
Well, I mean, of all the different publishers that I've had, I think I would say between, I don't know, I do like Bizarro Pulp Press and Omnium Gatherum as well. They've been amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So have Villipede as well. But I would say that Crowded Quarantine, the effort that went into to making the book look amazing was I really appreciated that. And they released hardback editions. And
yeah.
So, yeah. And they are investing money in it, and they are, they do have access to like reviewers, and they always get reviews. And so, I mean, you really need, it's not enough, I don't think, for a publisher to just accept your book, typeset it, get a cover, and then release it, and then just wash their hands with it, which happens quite a lot, to be honest.
Yeah.
But through the quarantine, Adam and Zoe, they kind of look after the book, like they really care about it even after it's been released. So, yeah, and that's what you want for an independent publisher, I think, definitely.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the few. I submitted to him. He just had an open submission not too long ago. I wasn't accepted, but looking at the, because that's why I self-publish so much, is because that thing where you see there's so many publishers that just, they put the book out and here it is, and it's really up to you, the writer, to do the marketing, which of course, you know, you should do your own marketing, but if somebody's publishing you, they should be doing a lot of marketing as well, and I don't see that. So, you know, usually my take is, well, I'll just do this myself, since it looks like I'm going to be doing that anyway for the most part with a lot of these publishers. But Adam, I saw what he was doing over there, and I'm like, wow, this guy is doing something right here. The books look great. I mean, the website looks, he's doing everything really well, and the books he has out are incredible. So I'm excited to see Crowded Quarantine. Definitely, he's a guy I want to get on this podcast and talk to about all that, because I think, you know, in the coming year and future, he's, if he keeps on the course, he's going to be an important publisher in this genre.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think even as a writer, like, he actually doesn't get as much praise or acclaim as he should, because he's actually a really fantastic writer who has been published.
Yeah.
He must have about 50 books. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I couldn't believe. I know he had stuff out in Strange House a few years back. That's where I knew him from. But then when I was looking at Crowded Quarantine, all the stuff he had, I'm like, oh my god! Like he's been going. He hasn't been quiet. But yet, I mean, he's kind of flown under my radar a little bit. So, you know, I'd love to talk to him.
He's a lovely guy. He's a lovely guy as well. Like he's very humble and unassuming and. Yeah, he is. And for somebody who's really talented like that, and who is creating ripples, like in the UK, like I think he's Edgelit quite a lot, which is a convention we have in the UK, and he does a lot of touring with his wife and stuff, and he's always promoting, like he is so committed to it, but and he has had a lot of great publicity as well, but he's still really humble and his feet are on the ground. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I think you'd have a great conversation with him. Much better than the conversation with me, which is really distracted and multi-stranded and all over the place. Like he can keep a conversation focused. So.
Well, you got Unger House Radicals just came out with them, so you're going to want to check that out, since you know this looks like a class operation going on. Obviously, you're a class operation in and of yourself, sir. Anything coming out in the coming year?
Yep, I've got loads of stuff, actually. There was just a reissue of the science fiction book I was telling you about earlier on, The Folger Variation.
Uh-huh.
So that, I got a new cover, and it looks great. And just had a book launch for that on Wednesday. And the publisher of that, Shoreline of Infinity, are going to be putting out my next book, which is called I Dream of Mirrors, which is a kind of Kafka-esque horror story as well. Mm. I've got a book coming out with Tom Bradley, The Church of Latter-day Eunuchs, through Bizarro Pulp Press. I've got, what else is there? There's so many things. I've got a book with John Langan and Don Webb coming out, hopefully soon. I probably shouldn't say too much about that one yet, but that's in the pipeline. And what else is happening? I think I've also got a collection of screenplays coming out with Seb Dubinsky. I don't know if you're familiar with Seb Dubinsky.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's another
awesome,
massive idol of mine.
Yeah.
And just that also just reminded me that I'm also editing an anthology, a tribute anthology for Sebastian Dubinsky called Silence is White. And we've got some great people involved, like Ted Foster. And I just read a story for Paul Schwartz, which was amazing as well. So that's going to be a great book. I feel like I'm forgetting stuff, but if I go in, it will just get really, really monotonous.
Well,
So
have a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening. There's a lot of stuff happening. But you know that way, it's like all these books were all written months and sometimes even years ago, and they're just about to get published
coming
this
around,
year.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exciting stuff. So much stuff coming up for you. That's great. You know, I told you earlier, I don't even remember if it was on air or off air, but I told you you request a lot, and you just get rattling off that list of everything that's coming, and even all the stuff you do a lot of editing work too. So, you know, that's why your name keeps coming up to me, because not only are you putting out a lot of stuff, you're doing a lot of stuff for everybody else in the background as well. So that's why your name keeps coming up. And it's no wonder you're doing a lot of hard work and a lot of good work for everybody in and around the genre. And your name, obviously, I know who you are, and you know, I hope everybody else now who's not familiar with you or what you do has a greater appreciation, because you're a workhorse, sir. You are a workhorse in the bizarro and weird fiction realms.
Thank you, and so are you, by the way, because what you're doing with the podcast is also fantastic, and it's an amazing podcast.
I appreciate
I'm really
that.
Really proud to have been on it.
I appreciate that. I'm very proud to have had you on, Mr. Chris Kelso.
Cheers.
Mr. Chris Kelso Zongers. It's no wonder that he was requested a lot, because like I said, he's kind of really around the scenes, behind the scenes stuff a lot, and he has a lot of respect amongst his peers, so maybe his work isn't that prolific yet, but he is, as you heard, he's got a lot of stuff coming out, and he has been entrenched in the bizarro scenes for quite a while now. So check him out, Chris Kelso. His last release, Unger House Rules, just came out summer last year. He's also got a couple other books, like A Message from the Slave State, The Black Dog Eats the City, and he's got a lot of other work in some, you know, anthologies and stuff like that. So keep an eye out for Chris Kelso in the future as well. Zongers, as we close out another episode of Bizong, I'd like to remind you that we are available for advertising here on Bizong and on the other podcasts on the Project Entertainment Network. All you have to do is go to projectentertainmentnetwork.com, click on the advertising tab. You'll see the basic details on how to get the ads going. It's been really streamlined now that it's we're rebranded as Project Entertainment Network. So if you have a product or a book or you just want to promote yourself for a pretty reasonable cost here, and don't forget, you know, you're not just advertising on one show and it goes off into the ether. These podcasts stay around forever. Since we've become Project Entertainment Network, I've gotten to take a peek at all our demographics, ratings, and stuff. Bizong, you're going to get well over 500 listens a month, you know. So, and there's a lot of our back stuff, a lot of the stuff that went on a year ago is still getting hits, still getting listens. So, down the line, people are still going to hear your ad from the show whenever they play the episodes. So that's something to think about when you're considering advertising on Bizong. You're getting a very focused audience. So if you have bizarre weird fiction, you have a bizarre weird product, this is the perfect place to do it. Of course, check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/Bizong. And we are on Twitter at Bizong Podcast. So keep up with us there and all the good stuff going on. Of course, Project Entertainment Network is also running a Patreon for just a couple of bucks a month. You can get access to a drawing. You can get in a drawing to win Bizong show notes that include my world famous or infamous or not so famous doodles. So right there, for like $3 a month, you could win some Bizong doodles. And for just $1 a month, you get access to a lot of great value stuff. We have a lot of the hosts doing videos. I myself do a monthly video spotlight on some particular bizarro books that have had an impact on me that I think are important to talk about. So I do a video once a month about that. That's something cool you can check out too for just $1 a month. And there's other great levels of project of added value stuff you can get for your Patreon contribution. So I will not harangue you for any more money. This week, Zongers, I will instead let you go and listen to these other great Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
The Necrocasticon, the podcast that blends horror and heavy metal properties with a common connection, brought to you by hosts Token Tom Glock, Max Axe, Smoking Walt Hades, and Azrael Mordecai. Featuring interviews and more with the stars of metal and horror. The Necrocasticon, Mondays on Project Entertainment Network.
Armcast, Dead Sexy Podcasts. I'm your host, Armand Rosamilia. Fridays exclusively on Project Entertainment Network, where I interview authors, publishers, editors, artists, filmmakers, narrators, the lady from Walmart, whoever I feel like talking to. That's every Friday, Armcast, right here on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.